We just concluded a study of the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. While this is the third in that trilogy, we're not studying it chronologically because this book actually falls in between, actually between Ezra chapter 6 and chapter 7 in our study. We'll look at that in a moment. But if you look at chapter 1 of the book of Ezra, he gives us a time stamp. Chapter 1 and verse 3. Verse 1 says it's in the days of Ahasuerus, which we'll talk more about in just a moment. That's Xerxes, as it's often known in secular literature. And so then it says in the third year of his reign. Xerxes reigned from 486 to 464 B.C., so the third year of his reign would be about 483 when you read about this banquet, which we'll talk about when we get into chapter 1. Now, in chapter 3 and verse 7, you have another time stamp. There's actually one in chapter 2 and verse 16, the seventh year of his reign when Esther was made queen. But then when you get to 3:7, in the 12th year of his reign. And so that's why we put on the sheet here, 483 to 474. The book covers about 12 years, something like that. Or if you want to take that first three away, a little less than that, 9 years. So that's the time of the occurrences in this historical record. We have some other data there on your sheet about Xerxes. Nothing critical, but he is called Xerxes, the great son of Darius, and that his son was Artaxerxes I. All right, and so now, before I talk about the events occurring in this time period, I want you to look first at the part of your lesson that says the object of this book. Look at chapter 4 and verse 4. I suppose most everyone, I said 4, 4 is 414. I suppose most everyone in this class is familiar with the story of Esther. And the fact that there was a plot made to eliminate the Jews from the kingdom of Persia. In chapter 4 and verse 14, when Mordecai is reasoning with Esther, trying to persuade her to use her position as queen to try to avert this disaster. He said, if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. Mordecai was persuaded that God would not let his people be exterminated. One way or the other, he would provide for their protection. And then he suggests to Esther, maybe you're the one to avert this disaster. It's a very powerful statement at the last part of that verse. Who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this? That can be applied to so many cases. You take the case of Joseph in the Old Testament. When you start in Genesis chapter 37, it says the generations of Jacob are the story of Jacob. But immediately, Moses starts writing about Joseph. Why? Because without the story of Joseph, there'd be no story of Jacob. It's Joseph, his brother's hatred, him being sold into slavery, him becoming a ruler in Egypt, God revealing to him about the famine that preserved Jacob and his family. And Joseph, as it were, arose at a time that God needed a man like Joseph to do his work. And, of course, Moses was such a man. Not anybody could do the work Moses did. Daniel was such a man. And certainly, throughout history, we see God using people to accomplish his purposes. And the interesting thing about the book of Esther, the word God doesn't appear in it. And yet God's behind the scenes of what goes on to save his people, the Jews. If or without what happened here, unless God would have done it some other way, we would have not studied the book of Nehemiah. Why? Jews would have been annihilated. All those other books that follow that in time would not exist. And if the Jews had been annihilated, what does that do for the promise that God made to Abraham? It would void it. In your seed, all the nations of the earth be blessed. And Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and then the tribe of Judah, and right on down the line, and then David. And so the events of Esther, while it seems like it's just an interesting story, it's really a testimony to the providence of God. The word providence is related to the word provide. And God, in the shadows, you don't see him. He's providing for the fulfilling of his will, the accomplishment of his purposes, and the protection of his people. The Jews, physically, are no longer God's special people, but they were at this time, for a special purpose that God had in plan. And so the book of Esther talks about or demonstrates the providence of God. We'll have occasion as we go through the book to talk about some of these questions that are on your lesson. The turn of events causes one to ask why these happened. Why this event with Vashti? Why did she refuse? And why was it a Jewish young woman was taken to be queen? And why was it that Mordecai heard about the plot against the king? And why was it that Haman, who's exalted in the kingdom, hated Mordecai so much? And just one thing after another. Why did these things happen when they happened, the way they happened, and who brought it all about? So we'll be looking at that as we go through the course of our study. Very interesting book about the providence of God, as are these other stories that we have talked about. But then there's another purpose in the book, and this would be very important for the Jewish reader. They had a feast. You don't read about it in the New Testament, but the Jews observed this feast called the Feast of Purim. And where did it originate? First of all, the very name of the feast is unusual because the word Purim is Persian word for lots. Why was this feast called the Feast of Lots? The story of Esther explains that. And the very fact that they had this feast, that it was named like this, with this Persian word and related to the idea of lots, points to the historical foundation of this book. That it was, in fact, something that happened in history that accounts for a feast that was observed by the Jews for the next several hundred years. And even those who claim to be Jews today still honor the fact of that event. All right, who wrote the book of Esther? We don't know. Some think it's possible that Mordecai wrote it. I don't know who wrote it. We simply do not know, but it was accepted in the Jewish canon. The Jewish canon was 22 books. Included all our Old Testament books that you have today. They were recognized in the time of Christ, and included in that collection was the book of Esther. So the Jews accepted this as part of their canon or their inspired scriptures. Now there are five principal characters in the book. I want to spend just a few minutes looking at these characters. The first one is this king, Ahasuerus or Xerxes. How do we know that it's Xerxes? I'm not going to burden with class with all the notes that I have here on my sheet. I don't know if that'd be of any interest to you or necessarily value to you. If you're interested in it, I can provide you my notes. But one of the ways is a process of elimination. One is the identification of name. One is the identification of the same kind of character that this king had, that Xerxes had. And the chronology agrees. And if this is Xerxes, which the evidence seems to favor, then it also helps to explain some of the things that you read about in the book, like this lavish banquet. You'll note in chapter 1 and verse 3 of the book, for example, it talked about this lavish feast that he made. He gave a banquet. And you'll note who's invited to this banquet in verse 3. Princes, attendants, army officers of Persian Media, the nobles and princes of his province being in his presence. Go, if you will, hold your finger there and go to Daniel chapter 11. Now, Daniel, when did Daniel live? You remember? Was it before the story of Esther or after the story of Esther?
Before.
That's right. He was taken captive in the first captivity, wasn't he? 605. And lived into the reign of Cyrus. And one of the things about the book of Daniel is that he talks about future events, kings and kingdoms in such detail that people who deny the inspiration of the Bible say there's no way he could have written that in the 500s, 600 years before Christ, because there's just no way he could know all those things. Well, it's an indication that he was guided by the Holy Spirit. But over in Daniel chapter 11, well, first of all, I'll go back to chapter 10, 1, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. So here's Cyrus, king of Persia. And then in the first year of Darius the Mede. And then he said, I rose to be an encouragement and protection for him, that is this angel. And I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. And history bears that out. Three more kings did arise in Persia. But then there's a fourth one. And he said, he gained more riches than all of them. As soon as he becomes strong enough through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. That seems to be Xerxes. Xerxes indeed was planning an attack on Greece in the third year of his reign. And that's what you're reading about over here, this third year of his reign. He's got all these military people, his nobles together, and he wants to arrange this Grecian war. He went against Greece, but he failed. And you'll see in chapter 2 and verse 16 that Esther was taken to the king in the seventh year of his reign. That's when he waged the war against Greece and failed. And it's thought that this whole thing about the getting these women to assuage his loss of Vashti had to do with turning his attention from the losses of this war. We can't be certain about all of that, but that's an interesting thing. One of the interesting things about this fellow Xerxes is his cruelty, as testified by secular historians. And the reason that's important is because of the historicity of the book. Is this book really a historical account? Would a king actually issue a decree to destroy thousands and thousands of people under his kingdom? Yes. And this is not the only such incident in history. I've got notes here that talk about various other kings that have done the same thing throughout history and just eliminate thousands of people. So he's not the first one. He's not the only one that's done these kind of things. And his giving to excesses and riches, and those kind of things, his fury is attested in secular history. So, once again, if this is Xerxes, the character that is portrayed of him in history fits very well with what you read in the book of Esther, and again, supports the fact that you're reading a historical account about something that happened during his reign. All right. We have on your sheet Vashti. You don't read about Vashti anywhere else in the Bible. This is all we know about her. And there's some speculation about what position she held in the king's harem. Some feel like he wasn't the number one wife, that she was part of a group of concubines. I don't know if that's so or not. That's the reason she wasn't at the banquet to begin with. I don't know if that's so. One thing I did find interesting when I was doing some research on this, many of you have heard of Josephus, have you not? The Jewish historian. Josephus is a useful tool for study, but Josephus, I don't know how many times I ran across comments by those who compare Josephus with other historians and say Josephus sometimes is not correct. That's the beauty of studying your Bible versus studying the secular historian. You don't know if they're correct or not. Josephus, while we're glad to have his works, he wasn't always evidently correct. He makes a statement that it was contrary to the customs of the Persians for their wives to be seen by any men but their own husbands. But Herodotus, another historian, evidently more reliable, says that's not so. So you read these statements by men like this who are secular historians, just be careful. Some of you may have the book of Josephus, where he writes about the antiquities of the Jews and the wars. Valuable, good information. But just be aware, he was a Jew, and he was limited like all men are. And sometimes historians not only get their information incorrect, but want to rewrite history to favor their prejudices. And so remember that as you study Josephus. Any other comments about Vashti? We'll say more about Vashti when we study chapter 1. There are some views about Vashti and this request the king made that you'll read in commentaries that, so far as I can tell, are unfounded. Like one real renowned commentary says the king wanted her to appear naked. I don't know of anything that supports that, but you'll hear that. You'll read that. Be careful what you read. The text doesn't say that. All right, the next person we want to look at is Esther. Look at chapter 2 and verse 7. Who was her mother and father? Her living mother and father.
They were both dead.
She didn't have any, did she? She was an orphan. Her mother and father died. I don't know at what age, but she was an orphan girl. You see that in verse 7. bringing up Hadassah, that's her Jewish name. Evidently, Esther is her Persian name. We don't find that uncommon, do we? Look over at Daniel chapter 1 and verse 7. Who on this occasion were given different names? You're real familiar with this story.
Daniel
and his three friends, right? And they were given the names of gods of Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel 1:7, the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. To Daniel he assigned the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. We call them Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but that wasn't their Jewish names. And so you think today about people making excuses for not being able to serve God because of the society we live in. Daniel was taken to a foreign land, educated in a pagan university for 3 years, given pagan gods' names, but his faith stood, so did his three friends. Here's this young woman who's evidently in a foreign land, away from the homeland. Don't know much about her history, but her parents died young, or died sometime back then, and her uncle's been raising her. And so she's got all kind of things she could complain about. She's an orphan. She's in a foreign land. She's given a Persian name. But the indications are she still holds to her faith in the one true God. You find that with Joseph, who was taken into a foreign land. Yet he held his faith in God. So all the excuses that are made for young people today for not serving God in our society are excuses. That's all they are. We have too many examples of people who, in very difficult circumstances, continue to serve God. So you see about Esther that she is was raised by her uncle. We don't know at what age. And In chapter 2 and verse 15, we see her father's name, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai. So Mordecai and Abihail were brothers, and that was her dad. Verse 5 says that Mordecai was a Benjamite. You see that in verse 5? A Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. So if Mordecai was a Benjamite, then his brother was a Benjamite. So what about Esther?
She's a Benjamite.
She's a Benjamite, isn't she? So she's a Jew. She's a Benjamite. You know that because of these family relations that are spelled out for you. There are some other things we see about her as we go through the book, and we'll have occasion to observe those, but let's look right now just some characteristics of her character. In chapter 2 and verse 20, we see, we read in chapter 2 that she's a beautiful young woman. She's a virgin, evidently, because that's what was sought out. In chapter 2 and verse 3, gather every beautiful young virgin. I don't know what age she was, but she was evidently not a promiscuous girl. She was a virgin and very, very pretty, evidently. And yet she was humble. Chapter 2, verse 20. Esther had not made known her kindred or her people, even as Mordecai had commanded her. For Esther did what Mordecai told her, as she had done when under his care. So here she had been under his care, being raised by Mordecai. But look where she's at now. But she doesn't let that go to her head. She still respects Mordecai who raised her. She has that sense of humility and respect for Mordecai, even though she's in this exalted position as the queen. In chapter 4 and verse 16, verse 15, Esther said, told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, day or night. I and my maidens will also fast in the same way. And then I will go into the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish." In other words, her life was not the number one thing. It was the saving of the people. There was a greater purpose she saw than just saving her neck. And she was willing to expose herself to this danger because of the fact that her people were in jeopardy. So you see again her humility. In chapter 7, in verse 3, at this banquet with the king and Haman, verse 3, Queen Esther replied, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me as my petition and my people as my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now, if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king." Notice the very humble approach that she takes. Not a bold, antagonistic, prideful approach. "I wouldn't even have bothered you if it had just been slavery. But they want to kill us." And so she comes to the king with that spirit, and it registers well, real well with this man. And then in chapter 8 and verse 3, Esther spoke again to the king, fell at his feet, weeping, implored him to avert the evil scheme of Haman the Agagite and his plot which he had devised against the Jews. And again, you see the very humble approach that she takes to the king. So she's a woman of beauty and purity, but a woman of humility. In chapter 2 and verse 10, you see also she's a woman that has self-control, at least to some degree. Because it says in chapter 2 and verse 10, she did not make known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had instructed her that she should not make them known. You know, stop and think about in conversation with the other women, conversation with the people in the castle, maybe in her conversation with the king, would she be able to hold this to herself? But she did. She was able to do that. And so you see a woman who's more than pretty. She's got some character traits here that we see. And you see it again in verse 20. Esther had not yet made known her kindred or her people, even as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther did what Mordecai told her. So she had that kind of control. And in chapter 4, verse 16, while you're looking at that, you see also that she was evidently religious. She's willing to give herself for the preservation of people. She said, tell them to pray for me. She believed in prayer, to fast for me, and I'll go to the king, but if I perish, I perish. In other words, God may not answer the prayer the way I would like for him to answer my prayer. But she did evidently have faith in prayer and asked for the prayer of the people in her behalf. So here's a woman in a foreign land, in a pagan society, around pagan people all day long, but she evidently had faith. And in chapter 8, in verse 6, you see her loyalty. It's also reflected in that verse I just read. But in 8:6, how can I endure to see the calamity which will befall my people? How can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred? Go back to chapter 4 again. We just read about her praying, her willingness to go to the king, her life at stake. We'll notice when we get to chapter 5 that she knew if she went before the king and he didn't extend the scepter, she'd die like that. These kings' life meant nothing. They utter you to be killed, thrown in the fiery furnace, whatever. And so came about on the third day, chapter 5, 1. She put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace. So you see her courage to be willing to face a very challenging, I mean, life and death situation, because she had a higher purpose than life itself. She'd be an interesting woman as we study through the book, this woman, Esther, young woman. Sometimes we think about women with courage, women with humility, and women with loyalty. You may think of an older, gray-haired woman. But this is a young woman who displays these traits, and there's no reason we can't think of young women having those kind of character traits even today. Any other comments about Esther? You put notes down there to share with the class. I'm interested in them. Look at Mordecai. We already noted that he's a Benjamite. It's interesting to me in chapter 2, both verses, verse 7 and verse 15, that it talks about him raising her. Mordecai was a man who accepted the responsibility that he felt like he had toward his niece. So many times people today are too busy with life to accept those kind of responsibilities.
Steve?
Yes.
You keep saying Mordecai's uncle. Is he an uncle or is he a cousin?
Esther's his cousin. What am I saying?
You're saying uncle. You're saying she's his niece.
Cousin, sorry. Thank you. Wrong track. Cousin. And people don't even find time to raise their own kids, much less somebody else's. I don't know anything about Mordecai. I don't know if he had a wife. I don't know if he had a family. The Bible doesn't tell us. That's one of the things about the Bible. If we were writing the Bible, if somebody wrote the Bible just for to satisfy human interest, you think those details wouldn't be given? Sure they would, but that's not the purpose of this book. There's so many of these details we'd like to know, but this book had a purpose. And Mordecai's family and what happened to his family, we don't know. But it's interesting that he accepted this responsibility to raise this young woman and evidently raised her in faith. You know, when you read here in chapter 4, that she was willing to accept this responsibility out of her commitment to her people. Rod, did you have a comment? Did I see your hand go up? No, okay.
I was just agreeing with your comment about writing the Bible.
Okay. I found it interesting in my studies that some of the Jewish expositors think that Mordecai held a high office in the Persian court. There's nothing in the text about that. But there are a couple things that would coincide with that. Maybe so. For example, in chapter 2 and verse 11, It said Mordecai walked back and forth in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and how she fared. Why was he allowed to do that? Walk back and forth in front of the court of the harem. If he was an officer in the king's court, that would explain that liberty. And in 221, in those days, while Mordecai was sitting in the king's gate, and that's where he learned about this plot against the king. Why would he learn about it? Well, maybe because he associated with these kind of guys. He was in that circle. And so, again, I don't know how reliable that is, but I could see that fitting well, that if Mordecai was one of the Jews who had been given some kind of position or responsibility in the Persian government, and if so, that would set the stage for the event that took place. Yes. Well, by that time, he is exalted.
Okay.
Earlier, yes. Yeah, no question at 9, because he has been exalted. All right, and then chapter 3, this will be an interesting thing when we study it. Maybe you can supply some of the question marks that I have when we get there. But one thing about it, you can't deny that he was a man of courage. In chapter 3, in verse 3, Haman had been exalted. The king had issued an edict that people were to bow to Haman. But Mordecai, verse 3, would not do it. And so they asked him, why are you transgressing the king's commandment? Now it was when they had spoken daily to him that he would not listen to them. That they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reason would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. That's the reason he gave, I'm a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage. Didn't make Mordecai any difference. He'd get mad if he wants to. He's not going to bow down. Was it on religious grounds? We'll talk more about that. He said it because he was a Jew. If it is on religious grounds, you have to raise the question, what about the other Jews? Did they just crater? And we'll note when we get to this section that it was not out of something expected to bow down, to pay homage to a ruler. Doesn't necessarily mean you thought he was God. And so was this what the deal was, that Haman thought was being portrayed as a god? I raised the question about the other Jews. Or was it something to do with Haman and Mordecai that we don't know? Was it maybe that Haman was an Amalekite? Don't even know that for sure. We'll talk about that. The Agagite. We'll talk about that when we get to chapter 3 more. But I don't know if he was an Amalekite or not. But if that was the case, that might be a cause because of the history between the Jews and the Amalekites. But anyway, Mordecai was a tough guy. He was a man of courage. One other thing that we'll just note briefly. In chapter 2 and verse 5 and 6, there was in the citadel at Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai. And then it says verse 6. The first word of verse 6 is who? W-H-O. Who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah. Well, that took place in about 597 or 598. So if this refers to Mordecai, if the who refers to Mordecai, what's the youngest he would be? That was 597 or 8. What time are we talking about now? 468. So what's the youngest he would be? 120? 130? That's if he was taken over as a baby. Excuse me. And some think that's what he was, that old. The problem with him being that old, two things. One, would he then be made prime minister in a Persian government at that age, which he was later? And secondly, how old then was Esther? Because if his brother was the same age as Esther, and he had Esther when he was 60 even, man, she'd be 60. Doesn't sound like she'd be one of the young, pretty virgins. And even if his brother was quite younger and had her later, still puts Esther's age up there. So the who there may refer to Kish instead of Mordecai. But that's not an important thing. We just want to observe that since we're talking about Mordecai. You may read statements in commentaries or articles that Mordecai was 120. Maybe he was. I don't know that he was that old. Yes, Rick?
One of the things that we do have to take into consideration is that the Jews had generational names that were passed down from oldest to oldest. And sometimes we can talk about that. This might have been one of those generational names that were passed down.
Could have been. Okay. Along that line, in fact, Rick, when I was studying on this, one fellow that I was reading said he thought that it could have been like when the children and grandchildren went over to Egypt with Jacob. They didn't. They went in the person of the people who went over. And that this guy thinks Kish is the father of Saul. I'm not sure I agree with that, but that's what he thinks, because of this generational names that certain renowned names were used. But I don't know. Okay. Any other comments on Mordecai? Haman? We'll talk more about this in chapter 3. Just be careful of when you read, when it says in chapter 3 that Haman was the son of Hammedatha. No telling how I'll pronounce it next time. I give different pronunciations to these names every time I read them. But anyway, the Agagite, that you don't assume that that means he's the descendant of the king Agag. If a person is a descendant of Saul, for example, do they call him a Saulite? Or a Benjamite. And so if you're descendant of Agag, you might call him the Amalekite. And whether or not a descendant of King Agag is not determined by this particular phrase. Some think that's possible. I do not know. We don't know much else about Haman, what's in this book. We do know he was a very prideful man in chapter 3, verse 2. The king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman. I don't know if Haman was behind this edict for everybody to praise him or not. I know he's behind the edict to destroy the Jews. Whether or not he's behind this one, I don't know. But since Mordecai wouldn't do it, you see down in verse 5, he was filled with rage. And in chapter 5, in verse 9, after having eaten with the king and queen, he's really full of pride. And Haman went out that day glad and pleased at heart. When Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, they did not stand up or tremble before him. Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. And that's when his wife said, "Well, make a gallows and have him hang." He said, "I think I'll do that." Pride. Boy, pride gets us into trouble. Pride and anger. And anger often proceeds out of pride. There's a rightful kind of pride. But there's a wrongful kind of pride. There's a rightful kind of anger, and there's a wrongful kind of anger. But this man was eat up with pride, and it issued in his anger. Very vindictive, wanting to get even, and very deceitful. In chapter 3, in verse 8, when he approached the king, because of his personal vendetta against Mordecai, that's not the way he approached the king. In chapter 3, in verse 8, he said, "There's a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of all other people, and they do not observe the king's laws. So it's not in the king's interest to let them remain." He said, "This is not personal, king. I'm just interested in you and your rule." Hogwash. We always like to portray the best thing. Well, that's Haman. We don't want to be a Haman. But that's the kind of man that you read about here with Haman. Okay. I thought, sure, I would get through these contents, but let's at least get started. On the contents of the book, we've suggested that you just read the book. I don't know if you find this helpful. I find this helpful for me to break each chapter into sections to kind of get the flow of the story. And then if I'm studying that section, I know where I'm at. if you've got some kind of margin in your Bible, you can write out in the margin these various chapter divisions, these sections in the chapters. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, you're studying the book of Esther. There it is. You say, oh, yeah, I remember that's where we're at, right here in this section. So that's just a useful thing. If you don't want to do it in your Bible, print you a copy off your computer if you have a computer. Or we can make copies back here and you can do it that way. All right, so let's start chapter 1. The first 9 verses we gave you as an example, the king's feast. He made this feast in the 3rd year of his reign, very possibly having to do with a military expedition that he wished to undertake and wanted to get the support of all of those military people and people of rank and nobility in his kingdom behind him. But you find this lavish feast. Verse 10 through 12. All right, now, so we come down to verse 10 through 12 and... Excuse me. What'd you put for 10 through 12? There's no set in stone answer on this. Everybody's going to answer this a little different. What'd you put? What? Okay. Vashti refuses to listen to Artaxerxes. She refuses to come. You can put that several ways, but Vashti's refusal, you can put that, whatever, something like that. This begins to get the wheels rolling now. Why did she refuse? I do not know. There's a lot of speculation about that, but she did refuse. Had she not refused, the rest of this story would have been different, if we'd even had it. And so then you get verse 13 through 22. What's that section about? What? Vashti is banished. Vashti is deposed. You can write that several ways. Good. Vashti is banished or deposed. Vashti is no longer queen, however you want to put that. She's removed from her position. Again, this is important to the developing story. And so each one of these sections, you begin to see this story unfolding as you read the story. How much time do I have? Zero. Okay. We'll pick up and we'll do the contents and start with chapter 2. And the other lesson is on the table in the back. It's also on the web if you want to download it.